It's September the 25th, 2012. I'm Peter Lim, Africana bibliographer and adjunct associate professor of African history here at Michigan State University, and I'm joined by Professor of Sociology David Wiley for the latest interview in the African Studies interview series of conversations with prominent African Studies scholars at MSU. Today, we're very pleased indeed to interview Professor David Robinson, MSU University Distinguished Professor of History and African Studies Emeritus. After completing his PhD on Abdul Bakar Khan and the history of Futotoro at Columbia University in 1971, he taught at Yale until 1978, when he accepted an offer for a faculty position in the Department of History and the African Studies Center at MSU. In 1991 to 1992, he received the Distinguished Faculty Award and then became University Distinguished Professor of History and African Studies. He served as President of the African Studies Association in 1992-3 and Chair of its Committee on Current Issues, receiving ASA's prestigious 2009 Distinguished Africanist Award. David Robinson has served on numerous editorial and advisory boards. From 1990 to 1994, he was an editor of the Top of the Range Journal of African History, now incidentally co-edited by one of his doctoral students, Sheikh Babu, and he has advised many PhD students. Amongst his many books and articles on Francophone and Islamic West Africa, we have some very important works indeed, Chiefs and Clerics, Abdul Bakar Khan and Futotoro, 1853 to 91, from Oxford in 75, and then the very influential Holy War of Umatal, the Western Sudan in the mid-19th century, also from Oxford in 1985, translated as La Guerre Sainte al-Hajj Umar in Paris. And more recently, you've written leading works on Islam in Africa, such as Paths of Accommodation, Muslim Societies and French Colonial Authorities in Senegal and Mauritania, from Ohio University Press in 2000, and Muslim Societies in African History from Cambridge University Press in 2004, both since published in French. And in French, you've also co-edited two books with Jean-Louis Triot, Les Tombes des Marabouts et les Tijaniers. Plus, you have several collections of primary sources, Sources of the African Past in 1979, a book from MSU, actually published by the African Studies Center here, called The Islamic Regime of Futotoro, an Anthology of Oral Tradition, transcribed in Pula. And you played a key role in developing a very notable series of primary sources published by MSU Press, the African Historical Sources, in which you edited with John Hansen the 1991 collection, After the Jihad. And I'm reminded also that you joined us to interview Emeritus Professor John Hunter in the very first episode in this series back in 2003, and it's delightful to have you back on the other side of the interviewing table this time. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Peter.
So, David, let me jump in here, and since as a historian, you apparently think that history matters. So why don't you tell us about your own history and how does a young guy in South Carolina end up working in Arabic and Wolof and on complex histories in Francophone West Africa? What gets you started, and what is the kind of trail that you strode through to get there?
I think my answer to that question is I'm not sure, but I could demarcate some stages. I grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, and went through the public schools, which were completely segregated at the time. But at the white schools, you got a pretty good education, and I was able to get into Davidson College, which was not the only place I applied to. I think I applied to maybe Princeton, but there was something in the Northeast that Princeton was. Maybe Davidson considered itself to be the Princeton of the South, but it had a certain Presbyterian connection, which was my father's particular denomination. And then at Davidson, I think some of the influences that would ultimately lead to Africa developed. There was one with Johnson C. Smith, the Black University in Charlotte, and I think it was through the Y. This is, I'm struggling with my own memory here.
This is the YMCA.
The YMCA at the two schools brought us together. It was before the Greensboro lunch counter sit-ins, but not much before. That must have been 1960. And then I went on a, what was it? Oh, a WSCF, the World Student Christian Federation work camp, I guess it was called, and that was in southern France, and found myself with some very interesting people. There was an Arab from Nazareth, that is an Israeli Arab, who spoke about how awkward it was to be living there. This would have been 1958. And there were three people from others from the U.S., including a black student from Alabama. And in the course of working in, I think we were reconstructing a sort of retreat center for the French Reformed Church, which is the equivalent of the Presbyterians, we had discussions at night, including discussions about segregation, discussions about Israel and Palestine, all sorts of things that kind of pushed me in one direction. And somehow over the next year, and maybe it was through the Y connection, I got linked up with New York, initially a Y camp that must have lasted several weeks that was sort of on the west side of New York. And through that, linked up with Jim Robinson, the pastor of Church of the Master, which was on the western side of Harlem, and lived with a black family that were members of his parish. I think he was a railroad porter, and that certainly had some influence. It also produced some controversy that I've never been clear about with my own family, that apparently my father was, who was a very reserved, very conservative, but very reserved person. But I have reason to believe that he intervened with Pastor Robinson or somebody, that this was a strange thing for his son to be doing, but he never intervened with me and never objected to that. Anyway, Jim Robinson was, in addition to being pastor, the founder of Crossroads Africa, which was sending black and white young people, mostly students, over to Africa in the summer for work camps and, you know, to build a school or do something that they probably didn't have much talent for, but it made a big impact on them. And I almost went with that. Let's see, the summer would have been 59 between my junior and senior year, and I would have gone in the, after my senior at Davidson, I graduated in 60, but decided not to go, but to go to Union Theological Seminary, which was just up the hill from the Church of the Master, and that opened up the contacts at NSCF and at the National Council of Churches, and with Margaret Flory, who, this dynamo that we both got to know over that year, and you must have been at Princeton by then.
No, I was at Yale.
Oh, you were at Yale.
Doing the Yale Divinity
School. Anyway, she had great influence on us both and began to talk to both of us about the Frontier Internship Program, which started that next summer of 61 with maybe 10, 12 people in different assignments, and each one was sort of tailored, and each one was problematic in different ways, you know, until it finally happened. And the Dakar team that was doing social and medical work was initially going to take you and Mary Lee, but they didn't want a couple because they were all single. So they took me as a single white male. And so 1 year out of college, I arrived in France for a little bit of orientation with CIMAD. This was a team of CIMAD people. Most of the CIMAD workers or team members were in France or Algeria.
This is the Comité Intermouvement
Auprès des Évacués. Right. Really, it started with an Eastern European orientation, not anti-Soviet, but dealing with the kind of aftermath of the war and people that had been forced out and so forth. But probably by the mid-50s, they had gone into Algeria, probably not too long after the beginning of the war in Algeria. And so part of my orientation for about a week or two was to go to Algeria, which I found to be very attaching and attractive. And at some points over the next couple of years, regretted that I had not said, wait a minute, I think I'd rather stay here. But I was in as close to a wartime situation as I've ever been in, and there was a war going on, you would see the puffs of the plastique, the bombs that went off each night, and there was violence all around. And there was one trip through the mountains to a place called Media, south of Algiers, that required passing through checkpoints, and it had a curfew, and all of these were sort of wartime things. But I very much admired what the CIMAD people were trying to do in a difficult situation. And I don't know, I think they went past the 62 peace and the independence of Algeria. I don't remember exactly the date, but they probably pulled back not too long after that. I can't imagine that Ben Bella and Boumediene and company would have, with the very authoritarian regime, would have liked the independence of the CIMAD people very much. Anyway, I did go on to Senegal and found myself with three European colleagues, Dutch, English, and French, and I did youth work and some teaching over the next 2 years.
This was at the Centre de Bob.
At the Centre de Bob in Dakar, in Grand Dakar, it was called. So it was about 5 miles, I guess, outside of the town, outside of the downtown. And Dakar had all of the things that you see in Ousmane Sembène's films. About the plateau, the higher area at the bottom, which was where the Europeans and the wealthier Senegalese lived, and the government offices were, and we were about maybe 4 miles out from that, and worked my tail off. We didn't have much private life, but worked very hard, and I decided that I would rather go to graduate school and have a calmer, more predictable life than I had had as a équipier, we would call team members at the Centre de Bob. So I came back in the middle of 63 and took about a semester to make up my mind and enrolled in the winter term at Columbia, and then finally finished that dissertation in African history in 71 that suitably revised became the book that you were talking about. One interesting thing about that, while I was in Dakar, I worked on French, and my teaching, even when I was teaching English, was in French, and it was essentially translation. I tried to learn Wolf, and I guess I got a limited level of proficiency. But I read Shahamidou Khan's book, Ambiguous Adventure, which had been translated into English. I don't know whether I read the French or the English. And I was fascinated by it because it had such a cleavage, in part between French and African, but also between secular and Muslim. So Samba Diallo fascinated me, and the teacher that had so influenced him, and then his going to France and getting Descartes and all of the Cartesian secular thinking about the world, and then going back home, which was Futotoro, out of the middle valley of the Senegal River, and finding himself not able to cope. You're not quite clear what happens at the end, but he may well have committed suicide because he couldn't handle the cleavage. But that was what influenced me to think about Futotoro as a dissertation subject. That, you know, I thought of Dakar and by extension, unfairly, I think, Wolof culture as kind of corrupt and polluted and westernized, whereas there had to be this more pure, different, non-Western, and as it turned out to be, of course, Islamic culture that was way back in Senegal along the river on the border with Mauritania. So when I came back, I studied Arabic in order to be serious about Islam, and Colombia, of course, had Arabic. But I was very interested in Pular, the language of Futotoro, but I couldn't, there was no way to do that at Columbia. So I finally hooked up with Phil Curtin at one of the ASA meetings, and he invited me out to Wisconsin and then paired me with somebody who spoke the Pular or Fulfulde of northern Nigeria, who taught me and had some tapes. And so I got something of a start in Pular before I went to the field in 67. Now, the other thing that I should mention in passing before going on to the more academic, Dave and I both were very much involved in the student Christian movement in the 60s. Dave probably started before I did, but there was the National Student Christian Federation, which became the University Christian Movement at some point in the late 60s, and I was the president of it for a year. At the same time, to some extent, out of Union Seminary, where I still had contacts, we formed, what to call it, the Southern Africa Committee, but we did various things beginning in 65, especially with UDI in Rhodesia.
Where David Wiley had gone.
Thanks to where he had gone and come back, and that was an occasion to make sure that people had some information about what was really going on in Rhodesia and then, by extension, Southern Africa. So that transmogrified over the years with different titles into different newspapers and magazines, and has led in part to the activist activist archive here. It also led to an intentional group of people, about 10 or so, that formed around Dave and Mary Lee and me and others that tried to meet every year, and met one year actually in Zambia when Dave was there for his own research, but tried to meet every year for, I guess, 20 years, you know, until the mid-80s, and to do some things together. So that was going on. That was a kind of activist track at the same time that my father and myself and others were saying, finish the damn dissertation. So, you know, get a job.
It's a fascinating
get a place to live and so
forth. Of you. Yeah. You could have gone in different directions.
Yeah. Well, and I might add that one of the people participating in the NSCF and the UCM was Lynn Jondal, whose interview is also in the same series here, our local board representative to the Michigan State Legislature.
The forms of, you know, exchange and scholarly communication have changed, but they run deep. And maybe I can come back then to your historical studies and focus for a minute on that. And you must have seen and also contributed to many changing trends in African historical studies. You mentioned your work in the Senegal River Valley, your work with Arabic and Pula manuscripts, and of course you had a wider role in the United States and in Europe and globally and in Africa. What do you think have been some of the most significant changes since you first set foot in Senegal back in the 60s, and in terms of doing research and and writing history, and maybe you could also speak to major gaps that might perhaps still remain to be filled.
Oh, the gaps, I think, are more evident, and sometimes they're gaping holes. Not the beginning, but, you know, the African Studies Association began not too many years before Dave and I got involved, and Phil Curtin, and all of the people, most of whom have passed away, formed the ASA late 50s, maybe 58 or so. But and they were teaching at Wisconsin, and there was somebody kind of that generation at Columbia and
Northwestern.
Northwestern was big, and Northwestern was actually the oldest center, and UCLA was growing by leaps and bounds. In fact, I almost went to UCLA and decided to come to Columbia. But what I remember about the decisions that American Africanists made about what to do on a dissertation, and they were almost all white and mostly male at the time, was that you picked out an area that nobody had done, and hopefully not an Africanist had not done, and they were, of course, just getting started. So I picked Futotoro, the area that Sheikh Hamidou Khan wrote about and was from, and actually a very distinguished Futanki family, his particular Khan branch. And thought I was alone, and then discovered that Philip Curtin had a Futotoro candidate too, and that was Jim Johnson, who has worked with Alan Isaacman for a long time in the African program at University of Minnesota. But Jim and I sort of glared at each other first, what are you doing in my territory? And then decided that the other person was pretty nice after all, and that there was a lot to do. So Jim did the earlier period, and I did the later period of Futotoro, and then we both interviewed, and we shared the interviews, and in fact, some of Jim Johnson's material may be actually in my collection, and he wrote a dissertation on Futotoro up until 1830-something, and then I started with this man, Abdul Bokar Khan, who's an absolutely fascinating, very secular, pragmatic Muslim of Futotoro, who survives until the French put a bounty on his head in 1891 and gets wiped out. But he held his own with the French for a long time, so he's a fascinating figure. And my interview area, as opposed to Jim's, was sort of in the heartland of Abdul Bokar. Anyway, to get back to your question before I forget it completely, you know, we had this way of delineating subjects for research, at least in African history, which was just a really developing field. I spent that semester at Wisconsin with Curtin. Vancina was not there, but Neil Skinner was there and some of the other folks. And a wonderful collection of emerging historians of Africa. Joe Miller was there. You could almost recite the people who, by the 1970s, had found good places and were going to be teaching African history. And they demarcated their areas in kind of the same way. You did pre-colonial. You didn't deal with the period after 1900. That was for the political scientists. That's what we ignorantly, maybe not stupidly,
and the sociologists
thought at the time of a sociologist. You know.
Anything after 1940 was right. For the journalist.
Right. And the social scientists, i.e. non-history social scientists, they were happy to leave the pre-1900 period to us that were crazy enough to try to do it. And then you had to apply the Vancina methods or see if you could to interviewing, and you had to do interviewing because the archival record was either not rich enough or too biased. So all of us out of that Wisconsin cohort, which I became a kind of adopted member of, or other places, Northwestern, went out with the idea of doing interviewing and did it, you know, sometimes better, sometimes worse, learned from it. We rarely followed Curtin of Ancina's directive to transcribe everything. That was just monumental. But we often got everything translated into general translations, and mine were into French, so I could find people in Senegal from 67 to 69 who could translate in French, and that's in the collection I've deposited here. And I think they're reasonably good. Somebody could, this will never happen, but, you know, somebody with Poulard in French could go over them and undoubtedly make a lot of changes. And then if someone had thousands of hours and salary to support him or her, could transcribe it, and that would be a wonderful record. So it's there.
You know, and in fact, there's a second David Robinson collection at Yale of from your earlier researches in Arabic. And
The Arabic. Yeah, the Poulard stuff is here.
So you've left behind you quite a repository for continuing work. And you continued in this vein, looking at the secular, but also the religious in Senegal. Mm-hmm. You worked it up in latter years to a marvelous book, Paths of Accommodation, where you look at the Muslim mm-hmm. Sufi orders and their relationship with the French colonial regimes. And by this time, of course, writing African history was starting to change. And mm-hmm. I've always thought that you gave us a far more subtle way of looking at these relations between Africans and European colonialists than the earlier duality of sort of resistance collaboration. You started to mm-hmm. tease this out in some ways that that showed us the complexity of history. So was this another thing that was developing? And by this time, of course, you'd come to MSU in 1978, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But obviously by the time, certainly by the 90s and the 2000s, you're starting to write slightly mm-hmm. different approaches to African history.
We should get back because Dave had a lot to do with recruiting in 78. Mm-hmm. But we can get back. I think your earlier question is still, and maybe we'll run with it throughout the interview, how has the field of African history changed? And one part of it would be that, you know, those terrible collaborators who were interpreters or running the telegraph line or, you know, in other ways facilitating the French conquest or, you know, the British conquest or whoever's conquest, those people were perhaps not so terrible after all or not so uninteresting after all, and quite often left interesting records and had their own reasons for working with the French and maybe their own limitations on what they would do and not do with the French. And I think Aboubakar Khan, going back to that first book and dissertation on which it was based, showed that he would selectively cooperate with, you could call it collaborate with, from time to time, but always preserving his own autonomy until that became impossible and French were, you know, bound to stamp him out.
And the same with Bamba later on.
And then Alhaji Umar, Alhaji Umar is very different in Mali historiography or Mali memory and in Senegal memory and historiography. Mm. For Senegal, he is he's a hero of Islamization. Thank goodness in Mali and not Chenu, that he led tens of thousands of people to wipe out one or two Mandinka kingdoms and especially these big Bambara states that were on the Niger River or close to it. So there's that conquest theme in the Senegalese memory, but there's also resistance to Faidherbe and the French. And quite often, Senegalese history is a kind of bookended thing between Faidherbe, the French visionary, who also does a lot of things from the mid-50s to the mid-60s in Senegal and establishes the forts and some of the infrastructure. And then on the other side, Al-Haj Umar, who fights Fader, fights the forts very carefully because he realized that he didn't have artillery. He did get a couple at the end, but they were kind of used cannon. So he knew he was at a disadvantage, so he would have to lay siege to Medine, which was the great battle of 1857, during the dry season when the French were going to give out of food, the French and their Senegalese collaborators, and the Fader could not get up the river because there was not enough water in it for his gunboats. But he wasn't able to pull it off, and in July, Fader gets up there, and there, you know, there's a great liberation of Medine, and the commander is a hero. He's a mulatto hero, by the way, from San Luis. So that's part of the Senegalese image of Al-Haj Umar. And in my book, I deal with that, but I hasten to add that that really was not what Umar was about. He needed recruits. He was had terrible problems that Fader and the French created by this line of forts along the river that his envoys had trouble with, and they, you know, they might get killed or something as they went back to Senegal to these areas that were already Muslim, where the invitation to jihad would, you know, could evoke some response. And he succeeds in getting probably 40,000 people in 1859, despite the infrastructure Fader had put in place. But there is a conflict, but after 1859, it's over. And in 1860, there's a treaty that is passed, it's never ratified, but that is operative for a long time. So I tried to say that in my book. And
after explicating that history, you then move on to a later period still.
Later, right.
Sheikh Amadou Bamba, and again, you're dealing a lot with the relationships of these two cultures.
Yeah. Well, and I think these people, Bamba and Malik Sy, who is in Tiwawan and who's kind of the favorite of the French in the 1890s and early 1900s, they are all dealing with Al-Haj Umar and what I would now call, I think I might have called it that 30 years ago too, the failure of Umar's jihad to really implant Islam in Mali. He was much more about conquest and destroying paganism. Now, that was one of his slogans, the destruction of paganism, and he'd been authorized to do when he was on the pilgrimage to Mecca. Much more about that than he was about building mosques and schools and creating an Islamic culture in Mali, partly because he'd gotten so engaged in war and he had created so many enemies that he couldn't take time for the nation building, shall we say, spreading Islam in ways that the Bamba and the Soninke and the other indigenous peoples of Mali would have accepted. So I think that for Bamba and for Malik Sy and for other of the Senegalese and Mauritanian marabouts who, you know, come into leadership, and the word marabout is emerging by the time of my paths of accommodation, Umar is an example of what not to do. And they don't collaborate willy-nilly either. They're selective in their collaboration, but they're not about to declare jihad of the sword. They're about or challenge the French on political grounds. They want the social and economic domain, and that's, the French are happy to cede that to them to a great extent. And of course, Bamba is the big example, not Bamba himself, but his brothers and others get into peanut cultivation in a huge way in the Wolof areas of Kayor and Bao in the 1890s, they really are starting, and then it booms in the 20th century and becomes the big export of Senegal. And Bamba will exercise, or his successors will exercise, a great deal of autonomy within the area of Touba and Mbaké and so forth.
We might come back to Muslim societies in African history, but by the time that you were moving on to these areas, you'd come to MSU, and late 70s was also a time when David Wiley came here, and you started to attract graduate students. And Dave, what were your first memories of David Robinson here at MSU?
Well, we were at an extraordinary time when my predecessor in African Studies, John Hunter, whose interview is also in this series here, convinced the provost that it was time to really ramp up the quality of MSU's African Studies faculty to develop a larger center and a more prominent one, which decision, you know, leads directly to now MSU's for almost 30 years producing more PhD dissertations than any other. And at that time, the decision was made, where can we find some superb scholars? We found two of them at Yale. One, the first of these was David Robinson, and also Carol Meyer Scotton, who becomes the leading sociolinguist of Africa in this country. We found Michael Bratton, who was coming out of Brandeis University and who's invented the Afrobarometer. And several others, and including increasing the quality of the African language program, which was key to supporting the African history and other African studies programs. So that decision really was made. We cast the net open, but when we learned that David was willing to consider coming to MSU, we knew that with Harold Marcus, who was here at that time, that he would become the linchpin of this distinguished African history program. And I think the tradition that Harold and then especially David established here has attracted others, which makes it probably the most distinguished African history faculty in the country at this mm-hmm. time, when other places that had that record at one time have receded and backed away from Africa. But anyway, it seemed to me that David brought a new curriculum, seminars that were attracting graduate students, and with Marcus on Ethiopia, folks on Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa, really started to attract this stream of both American history PhD mm-hmm. candidates and Africans as well, mm-hmm. a whole series of them who then opened the door then to this to history and to a new quality of African studies at MSU. So it was a key and deciding moment, I think, in, the, mm-hmm. in that time.
What are some of the highlights of these years then, David, for you? I mean, or some of the graduate students. You shared with me a long list of 60 graduate students at MSU in African history alone. And obviously some of those studied with you, some with Harold Marcus. And what are some of the highlights of these students that you advised? I know there's an awful lot of them, but...
Yeah. Well, maybe I could talk generally about the program. Mm-hmm. The history department, before this decision to upgrade that Dave was talking about, had hired Jim Hooker in the early 60s, and he was, like Phil Curtin and like so many, he was a sort of a retread. But I think he did his dissertation on the British in Malawi or Nyasaland, probably. And then Harold joined by the late 60s, and they had a very small graduate program. Mel Page was in it, and Bob Boder, I think, but it was really still small scale. Then Jim Hooker died, and it was into his position, in a sense, that I came. The additional, it wasn't that I was attracted away from Yale. I also had to leave Yale. My time was running out. I had been promoted, but without tenure, which Yale did back
then. Often happens,
yes. And it was clear that for various reasons, I wasn't going to ever be tenured at Yale, and this wonderful opportunity came up. So in 78, I came out. But we didn't have a very big graduate program at the time, and our seminars must have been small, and we probably scrambled to get some Americanists or maybe some anthropologists. And probably the mid-80s before we really had a sort of mass, not massive, but that we had maybe 8 or 10 people in the program, and we would have a seminar where we would have 6 or 8 or maybe 10 people. And that stayed stationary for a while, and then in the 90s it grew and it stayed high through the early 2000s. And then Harold died, Elizabeth Eldridge resigned, and so in that crucial period of the early 2000s, I was the only one in the department, and then you came in, Peter, to provide some wonderful support and knowledge for especially the people on Southern Africa. And then we were fortunate in 04, 05 to get support for new hires and brought in the four
amazing Africanists. Yes.
Yeah, so all of whom are still here and attracting students in their own right.
And you were actually attracting some Senegalese students and others studying in West Africa.
Yeah, mainly Senegalese. And in fact, my adopted brother was the first of them. Mustafa Khan came here in 1980. His father had really adopted me, and then he passed away about 77. And I stayed in touch with his family, and he was teaching in high school. And anyway, we engineered things, and he took the TOEFL, or the equivalent of a TOEFL, and was admitted to Michigan State and came in 1980. So he gave us a Senegalese student for the first time. I think we already probably had Ethiopians. Tassema Taa was probably here by then.
Frank
and that began to change the program. Yeah. And then Mustafa was able to teach Pular. And we had a few students. So we had a tradition of teaching Pular. We developed links with Sonia Fejerberg Diallo, who was a Wisconsin linguist PhD, who specialized in Pular, and we used her textbooks. And so that made a big difference. And then, we didn't get other Senegalese here until the 1990s. Mustafa died of liver cancer in 1995. By that time, or just at that time, Cheikh Babou, whose full name is Cheikh Anta Mbake Babou, which just shouts out his Murid connections. The Babou family was very important to Amadou Bamba, and they live in Mbake. I visited there with him about 10 years ago. So it was actually Mustafa, who was still in good health, who introduced me to Cher in Senegal in January of 95, and we got Cher here in the fall of 95, just after Mustafa passed away, and the liver cancer went very, very rapidly. And then we had Mariam Jawara, who finally finished this last year on the Muslim pilgrimage, and we had Ibrasen coming in after that. So we didn't have the strong stream of Ethiopian students that Harold was able to secure.
But you also recruited some Americans and others to study West Africa, Hansen. Looking at the topic of his dissertation, he takes on... takes off where you finish after Umatal. Because you two edited a book published here on African historical sources, and he went on to finer things at Indiana.
Yes, and still is doing them. One of the things that I've enjoyed the most is publishing 3 books with former students. First one was with Douglas Smith, who was an undergraduate at Yale, and we did Sources of the African Past. And then Mustafa and I did the book that you referred to that the African Studies Center published that was based on small segments from my interviews that Mustafa transcribed and translated. And then we did a commentary and published that in an old system where we had to substitute a special IBM ball in the typewriter when it came to doing the Poular letters that were not in the English alphabet, yes. You know. So it was a very arduous production process, unlike anything, you know, you would find all of those letters and ways to do it on the word processor now.
Of course, the technology has changed, yeah. And you and Dave Wiley collaborated in many different ways in the last few decades on projects on Africa, the digital realm, also Mark Kornblu on HNET. Right. You became a founding editor.
Yeah, let me finish a couple of things before we get to that. The third book that I did with a former student was the one you were mentioning with John, and there we took mainly Arabic materials. Neither of us was terribly proficient in Arabic, but we got some help from Malik Bala and from other people around. And so we took some documents, a lot of them from Harris, a collection that Colonel Archinard, one of the conquerors of French West Africa, stole in 1890 from Ségou, which was, it had become the capital of the Umarian kingdom, such as it was well after Umar's death. But he took lock, stock, and barrel and I guess put them in huge wooden boxes and sent them to Paris. And 10 years later or so, they wound up at the Bibliothèque Nationale and they got archived more or less. And John and I worked from that. By that time, there was a pretty good bibliography of that collection that was the byproduct of an NEH grant to Yale for Arabic manuscripts from Timbuktu. And the intention initially, I think that was 78, and I had not left Yale then, Lewis Brenner and I ran the grant. NEH was going to support us for 2 years and Renewable for two more in a translation program. And we were going to develop a photographic system with strobes and hand it over to the Arabic Manuscript Center in Timbuktu. And they were going to begin to photograph those things. So I actually wrote a manual for using this thing, wrote it in French and took it up there and did some training as best I could in 79 and left it there. Shortly after that, the director of the center, who had very good contacts with LESCO, the Arabic equivalent of UNESCO, felt that he could get support for this project from, let's say, Arab sources or Islamic sources, and so decided that the original idea where one microfilm of everything that was photocopied would come to the Yale Library was no longer going to be allowed. And he persuaded the Alpha Umar Konare, who was director of the Institute of Human Sciences, you know, well before he became minister and then president. He agreed to that. I think he probably was not very enthusiastic. So we lost the NEH renewal, but we still had some money. And we used that money to hire a Tunisian named Khali, who did a very good inventory of the Ségou collection that had been rebaptized, the Archinard collection. So John and I and others working on Al-Hajj Umar or anything related to that period had a good source to know about 500 volumes of Arabic materials to know basically crudely what was inside of each one and where to go for particular groups of letters or particular manuscripts. And so John and I profited from that. One other thing that I'd like to come back to, which is your original question about how the field has changed, and there are many ways, but certainly in the 1960s, I expected, and I think most of my generation expected, that these African universities were going to take off, were going to get funded, were going to support research, and that American and African researchers based on the two continents, and Europeans as well, would be collaborating on projects and would be working together and would be competing. The African side of that did not really develop. The universities were Africanized, and Yves Persson, the French Africanist, had a great deal to do with getting African Africanists like Boubacar Barry in positions of leadership in the history department at the University of Dakar, which was going to become University of Cheikh Diop not long after that. So these people were in place, but the government didn't have the resources, and university didn't have the resources to support their research. So they really have to find that in France or North America. And in some cases, of course, eventually came to take positions in North America. And Cher Babu is at the University of Pennsylvania. And, you could go on with the African Africanists who've been trained in North America, who have realized that going back to the home country, even if it's fairly stable, is not going to be a situation of research. So that's got to be the great disappointment for the developing of the African history field and most African studies fields, that the African universities have generally not been able to take a leadership role in that.
And yet you've been able to put in place some bridges to at least try and come across and reestablish some of these linkages in the online world. And Dave, you must have been involved in grants with David Robinson.
Well, it was his scholarship and connections that were building those series of online digital libraries based on this material.
You've got the African Online Digital Library, and you've inserted into that and directed with the Matrix people some really wonderful online digital libraries on, for instance, on the Mourid and Saint Louis, and I think some of these projects are still coming along.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could talk to how these came about and what they might offer to the historian of the future in either country, Senegal or the United States.
Yeah. Well, the key development there was the history department recruiting Mark Kornbluh as an Americanist, and I think he came in 94, maybe 95. Got very good support from John Eadie, the Dean of Arts and Letters. And part of Mark's coming here was to switch Matrix, which at the time was called HNET, but a few years later took the name Matrix in order to have a broader horizon and mission. And Mark was very interested in Africa and African studies from the time that he came here. And so collaborated with Harold, probably first of all, and then with Dave and me. And by the late 90s, we had gotten some grants from the USIE, which Jesse Helms had not destroyed at the time and still had some resources.
U.S. Information Agency as part of the State Department.
And had some very good people in it who had served in posts and in Francophone and Anglophone Africa and so forth. And those were mainly training in the internet and more and more digital libraries for Africans. And so we recruited people from Senegal, from Nigeria, from Mali, from Ghana. Those were the four that I remember in the first couple of grants. And I remember watching the World Cup of soccer. 98 or 2000, I can't remember the year, and everything stopped for that, of course. And I think the finals were between France and Brazil, and the African people from Ghana and Senegal and so forth were very divided because they knew some of the Senegalese who were now playing for France, but they others wanted Brazil to win. But we had a good time with them, and I think made some impact. I'm not sure how much they were able to follow up on that with the broadband connections and the electricity and all the sort of infrastructural problems. But I think we made some impact. And about that time, we developed a digital library grant. Mark saw an opportunity with NSF, which had much greater resources than the USIA or NEH. And we got a big grant, 2000 to 2005 or six, for developing an Africa online digital library. And it was mostly West Africa initially. Now the Southern African stuff has come up. We also tried to get EFON, which is the research institute that was started in the late 30s in Dakar. It was Institut Français, and then it became Institut Fondamental, and they could keep their stationery and their letterhead. And they have a wonderful collection of photographs and archives, Arabic and Pular and artifacts from digs, you know, Paleolithic and more recent archaeological digs, to a wonderful collection and an operating budget that was mostly French through the 60s. And we tried, Mark and I, and Cheikh Babu was a graduate student here, so he went to Senegal with us as we were working on this. And we finally got EFON to write a suitable proposal, not for NSF, but for CRDI, which is the Canadian Development Agency, sort of the equivalent of USAID, and they have a representative in Dakar who is Senegalese, who was an old friend of mine there. And he finally got a proposal that he thought was acceptable and gave EFON about $75,000, I think, which has enabled them to put in a scanning library and computers inside of the main library at EFON. And they've done a little bit of scanning, but they are still very suspicious of this medium and of disseminating the EFON materials. They still want people to come to EFON, so they're still in the old mentality. And I don't know, been through several directors. Scott Pennington has gone over to train their people. Nothing has been able to break that loose. But we made the effort, and that was by that time we were trying to develop a partnership with the University of Dakar that has shown some results, and it still exists out of a bioeconomy program that developed in the College of Agriculture here. But the relationship with EFON and the hope that we would be getting some of those materials that would remain in the possession of EFON but would be available for people to consult digitally was one of our hopes for several years and was sort of part of the partnership, and I think would have made a big difference if EFON had been able to change its culture, and it really was sort of a culture thing. So we did, to come back to Matrix, and we did some digital libraries then, and then about 2006 or so, we went to the National Endowment for the Humanities and got a grant with people from Indiana, including John Henson, to do more digital libraries, and NEH supported that, and they've just supported a new grant that Chris Root piloted through the review process. We only got two-thirds of what we asked for, but it's with the same group of collaborators at Indiana, and building more libraries, digital libraries around Senegal and Ghana, and Muslim societies which practice tolerance and pluralism and all of the things that the Islamophobes refuse to associate with Islam, trying to show from Senegalese and Ghanaian examples.
And the listeners can listen and view a lot of this material at the African Online Digital Library.
Right. One of the things I think all that reflects, David, is your commitment to partnerships with your African colleagues, and the fact that there's this string of Senegalese scholars coming to study with you, I think reflects the respect for your work and respect for your seeing Senegalese scholars and informants as equal partners who deserve respect and credit. And all that was sort of capped off when a few years ago when the University of Dakar, then Université de Cheikh Anta Diop, after giving no honorary degrees for 5 years, gives their first one to you and another MSU scholar. I wondered if you can, out of that, kind of reflect on your own philosophy of partnership with the Africans and how that has been reciprocated. You just spoke about the difficulties of IFON, of sharing the materials, which all of us have experienced all across Africa, the feeling that here we are to mine their intellectual gold again. But you clearly have made some bridges that are sort of unique among our faculty, and I wonder if you could say where that is now and what your feeling is about that history.
Well, I'm not engaged in that very much, but we certainly have built some bridges, and I think people like Shebabu and Ibrasen, even though they're based in American universities, will be continuing those bridges and going back to Senegal for research. And on the other side, people like Ibrahim Achoub, who's been the long-term head of the history department in Dakar, is also looking and is extremely well-connected and has been very successful in getting grants, not grants that will sort of transform or change the underlying structure of weak support, but will allow people to do some interesting things. And under Ibrahima's leadership, all of the master's theses at Dakar are now online, and I think we have a copy of that. Did we purchase a copy? And the University of Paris 7 has a copy of that. But those are real treasures done recently in some cases, but also going back to the early 1970s by this group of very talented Senegalese like Boubacar Barry, like Abdoulaye Bachelet, who went on into government, like Mohamed Mbodj, who teaches in New York, like Mamadou Diouf, who teaches at NYU now. Those were sort of leaders in Africanizing the history department at the university and developing a kind of list of useful master's theses that incoming students would work from and then would write up sometimes 150, 200-page master's theses. And now Tube has gotten those scanned and available. I don't know how widely available he wanted to sell the CDs, but I think that's a very important treasure and will show American students of Africa the value of the work done in Senegal and the value of going to Senegal to continue to work. I wish we had the kind of oral data archive that was beginning to develop in Bloomington, Indiana, the Archive of Traditional Music, and Phil Curtin and others had a lot to do with. That would have taken enormous funding and custodial work and so forth. But that's the kind of thing that should be made available to students in Africa as well as the United States. Informants that I had or Jim Johnson had in the late 60s are all deceased. Those interviews ought to be consultable by anyone working on Futotoro in the future, but mostly it's by, I suppose they could come here to Special Collections or wherever you and Joe Lauer have put that material.
Oh, we can digitize them. There's some wonderful work being done in Southern Africa and Eastern Africa on oral interviews, so that could be the next step.
Yeah.
Maybe we could also, maybe to start to bring this interview to a close, we could maybe also talk a little bit about contemporary days, and obviously Islamic issues have been in the news in the in the last decade or so, and you wrote a very useful book, I think, Muslim Societies in African History, and published in 2004 and translated into French, and in that book, which is, I think, an exceptionally good textbook for undergraduates, you conclude the study by saying, quote, African Muslim societies will survive Islamism and transform their complex heritage again and again without losing the originality of their contributions to the faith. And I just wonder how you see it now, having spent a career interpreting, researching, publishing on Islam in Senegambia, how you see the complexities today of doing it?
Well, I think one of the dangers is shown by what's happened in Mali and Libya over the last 2 years. You know, there's a Arab Spring and an awakening and a lot of positive dimensions about what has happened in Libya in spite of the tragic death of the ambassador and those others a few weeks ago. But Gaddafi undid not what our generation did, but he did his part certainly in the undoing of some of the structures that had been built up in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Burkina and all parts of Africa, and had a lot of heads of state on retainers, and accumulated a tremendous number of weapons, which have gone to the his mercenaries or whatever, many of whom were unhappy Tuareg from Mali that he recruited in, or from Niger, and they saw the handwriting on the wall last year, and so fled back with their weapons. And they outgun, outman the Malian army, and so have fulfilled a dream which Bruce Hall wrote about in Study of Race in West Africa, this book that came out a couple of years ago, about the sentiments and the racism expressed by Tuareg and Arabs in the bend of the Niger and on up into the Sahara, regarding black people or people further south as either not Muslim, not capable of being Muslim, or if they become Muslim, inferior Muslims, and have back in the 1950s, he writes about how they want, as they see the handwriting on their wall, that Mali is going to become independent with this gigantic territory that the French call Sudan. It's about to become independent, and they start championing Azawad as the name for their area, going from Timbuktu and Gao on up into the desert, and essentially diminishing or stamping out the Songhai and the other African cultures of the river valley in favor of the nomadic cultures that were there. And of course, this has come to pass with the creation of Azawad in the last 6 or 8 months under some secular but increasingly Islamist leadership, using the Gaddafi weaponry that they've been able to bring in, and outgunning any Malian or West African force that really might come in. I don't know what, Dave would know a lot more about this than I, the Africa Command of the United States and the degree to which there are special forces or advisors in countries of West Africa and what they're doing about the Mali situation. But my guess is that it's not something that the U.S. Will be motivated to deal with or capable of dealing with, or if it tried to, would probably result in a disaster. So,
and the French haven't come in either.
The French have just, they were very involved in Libya, of course, and pushed the U.S. there. So I think it's worrisome, the wealth, and in this case, the armament, that Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and other Islamist forces willing to use violence against civilians at any cost and rejecting the much more pluralistic and open and often Sufi heritage of African Islam.
Which you have made your own, the study of over the decades.
Yeah, look at the...
In your published scholarship, your online projects, you've pointed to this toleration, this coexistence, this creativity. And,
Nigeria's, I would have said until a year ago, I would have said Nigeria is the place of greatest danger of Islamists taking over in the north particularly and stamping out a much more complex heritage. Even Uthman Danfodio, their hero, he was aware of the need for developing Islamic literatures in Pular and Hausa and having a more pluralist approach, at least once he got his regime established. So I think I'm afraid there's a lot of danger. I'll talk about the Subarian heritage probably too much because it's, thanks to Ivor Wilkes at Northwestern, it's the best known of these African innovations in an Islamic tradition, initially for Muslims who were living in among non-Muslim majorities 500, 600 years ago. In Ghana in particular, the time that it was called Gold Coast by some. But how do you cope? How do you be a good Muslim when most of the people around you, including the chiefs and the kings and so forth, are non-Muslim? And he developed a sort of a theology that I talk about that. But I think that kind of tradition is at some risk when you get the militants, and when you hear that the tombs of the Sufi saints in and around Timbuktu are being destroyed by people who consider themselves to be the only Muslims or better Muslims than the people who've lived for the last 1,200 years in those places, you get a little scared. That hasn't happened in Senegal, fortunately. I think there's maybe more danger in Mauritania, and makes me worry about the future. But I think in terms of Senegalese and Ghanaian history, we chose good examples of the complexity and the originality and the pluralism. John Henson right now is working, he will publish a book in the next couple of years on the Ahmadiyya Muslim group in Ghana, who came originally from India but indigenized within Ghana and were modern Muslims, in quotes, as opposed to the more traditional Muslim communities there, and have grown and have developed schools. And he will be, he's already done it some, but he will be publishing a book telling their story. So and we found in the town of San Luis or in the community of the Murids and in other places, other movements in Senegal, very good examples of people able to get along with Christians and Muslims who are of a different stripe.
Well, it's a lot of it. Dave.
Given Dave, your successful history of bridging, in some ways building your own bridges, but bridging with the African scholars and building teamwork with other historians in this country and with your former students, as you see kind of the new character of social political life in Africa these days, and as you see the kind of the African studies and with its without robust funding in spite of its successes at this time in history, what are your perspectives, your wisdom about what steps in this kind of context need to be taken by the Africanist community vis-a-vis Africa?
Well, I think WARC is one good example of what one could do. About 20 years ago...
This is the West African Research Center.
African Research Center, and it is the physical center in Dakar of the West African Research Association, which has institutional and individual members and is based in North America. But it has been able to secure some funding. Initially, it came from parts of the State Department. They've gotten some grants from other places since, some from the Smithsonian. I don't know. I can't take apart the funding, but the center has become a very important locus. It's got a good library. It's got internet access. It brings African and American scholars together. It's a good, it's a good place to work. And some of the faculty from University of Shahanta Diop have been able to come over and work there and teach there. A lot of overseas studies groups, I don't know how many there are. Emily would know much better than I. Go there and they are put in households to live for a while and do projects and quite often get interested in research. Now, when we started that, and Boubacar Bari and Mohamed Mbouj and Mamadou Diouf and I can't remember the other people, we were all involved with Mary Ellen Lane and the Smithsonian back in the early
90s. Centers for American Overseas Research.
Right. And this was the first center in sub-Saharan Africa, but it was not supposed to be the last. But right now, it is still the only one 20 years later. And I think that reflects a lack of commitment on the part of all sorts of organizations, private and public, to sub-Saharan Africa, as well as some problems of instability within Africa. But there's no reason there shouldn't be a center in Ghana, possibly in Nigeria.
Possibly Ethiopia.
I think that's a good model for collaboration and maybe a way to attract some institutional funding. I don't know whether the Gates Foundation would think about that. I mean, they look at particular problems rather than an ongoing research center and relationship. But I think that's been extremely valuable, and I'm sorry it's the only one. So.
Well, it's been a wonderful discussion, and we've covered so many different fields, so many different decades, and just shown why it was that both Michigan State University and the African Studies Association awarded you these Distinguished Africanist Awards. David Robinson, thank you very much for talking to
us
today.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.